Hey, I'm Jeff Cohen. Everything you hear on WNPR, from local news and talk shows to the national programs you love, is made possible because of listener support. You make it happen. You give the radio its signal, the computer its stream, the smartphone its podcast. You make it so we can reach you wherever you are. We love that you listen, but we also need your dollars. Go to WNPR.org and click on Donate in the upper right-hand corner. Thanks for helping out.
From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
This year alone, first daughter Ivanka's business in China is growing fast. She's seen at least two new trademarks approved by the Chinese, another one provisionally.
This is the 139th Easter egg roll. Think of it, 139.
O'Reilly is currently on a two-week vacation, the same time Fox News' parent company is investigating a woman's accusation that he ruined her professional career when she spurned his advances.
We express the resolve of the people of the United States of America to stand together in the months and years ahead with the people of South Korea.
30-year-old political newcomer John Ossoff fell just short of an outright win in a district held by Republicans since 1979.
Those are a few of the stories we've been following this week. You can join our conversation about the week's news, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin. How you doing?
Good morning. President Trump also said that the Easter egg roll is much more complicated than he had realized. Much more complicated.
Maybe we'll talk about Easter egg rolls later on. We're also welcoming today Chris Powell, managing editor of the Journal Enquirer newspaper. Hi, Chris. How you doing?
Very good. Thank you, Jim.
And thanks for coming in. Susan Bigelow is here, columnist at CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello once again, Susan.
Well, good morning.
Well, our big news in Connecticut, though, for the week was Governor Daniel Malloy saying he is not going to run for re-election.
A kid who was spastic when he was born was thought to be mentally retarded as late as the fourth grade, whose wife had to do all of his, type all of his papers as I dictated them.
It's the best job ever, and we've loved every minute of it, but it's a new chapter, and we're moving on. That's it.
That's Governor Dan Malloy from his speech announcing that he is not running with his wife, Kathy, by his side. It was an uncharacteristically emotional Dan Malloy making that speech. And we're going to talk a little bit about not only what happens next, the legacy of Dan Malloy, who might be running for his seat. But maybe we'll start with this, Colin, and ask about the timing. I was a bit surprised, as many other observers were, that as Governor Malloy is attempting to negotiate a state budget deal, he's working with a different type of legislature that has a different constitution than it has in recent years, with a split Senate, and trying to negotiate with state workers on concessions once again, that he would, before that whole process is over, say, you know, I'm going to make myself a lame duck.
Yeah. I just want to say one thing about that clip, which is, and I hope this doesn't sound callous, but I think I was the first person to interview Dan Malloy about his dyslexia. It was either in 2006 or, you know, early in the 2010 campaign. And, you know, back in those days, he kind of go, yeah, I had dyslexia. It was really hard, you know. And as the years pass, it's like an Oliver Sacks novel or something, you know. It's just like his impairments get more dramatic, and now he's verklempt about it. And I'm sure that's much closer to the truth. Initially, he was unsure about whether even to talk about this. I think now is probably a bad time for him to make this move. On the other hand, I don't think he had much choice, particularly given the future of his party. I mean, somebody or a series of somebodies whom we'll be discussing later has to raise $250,000 in small donations in order to qualify for the Citizens Elections Program. And those somebodies have to get started pretty soon. And it's, you can't do that very easily if people are going, well, what about the governor? Is he going to run again? So, I mean, he kind of had to do this as soon as possible. I'm sure there was a lot of pressure coming from a lot of different quarters to do it. But, yeah, he is right in the middle of the Lion Tamer Act, you know, and he's just announced to the Lions that it's, you know, he's not that interested in doing this anymore.
Well, is there any way in which this frees him up to do something he wasn't able to do before? As I say those words, I think to myself, well, what is it that Dan Malloy wouldn't have said to someone that he can feel free to say now? But is there any way in which he plays this out into a stronger negotiating position for himself or the Democrats vis-a-vis this budget?
I'll be interested to hear what Chris and Susan say about this. Obviously, the place where he needs – to be able to maneuver better is in the negotiations with state employees. I mean, he doesn't have any obvious successful strategy that's evident to anybody else right now. I think the other thing that it might give him, even though he's had a pretty fractious relationship with his own party and with the other party, and when people are leaving, sometimes they can get certain things. And I think, as we're talking about his legacy, which we will do, the so-called second chance initiatives, the criminal justice reforms, things which have been stalled, I think, more out of legislative procedure and overcaution, and they get stuffed into omnibus bills, and everybody has something that's wrong with them. And this time they're going to be broken apart. This might be the kind of thing where he really could use whatever goodwill he still has left for these people and say, look, this is important. I'm not going to be here anymore. Let's get this done. And I think that would be a really good thing. But, I don't know. I'd be interested to know what the other panelists think. In terms of the budget stuff, which is hard and intractable and really involves getting people to do stuff that they passionately don't want to do and don't think they should have to do, I'm not sure that giving him a freer hand or an ability to break more china at Pottery Barn, helps him out all that much.
Chris, what do you see in the timing here? Do you think that this is a good move by Malloy making this announcement right now, as we've said, he's in the middle of this very delicate negotiation?
Well, it's a good move for his party. It gives his party plenty of time to develop candidates who can separate themselves from the administration. It gives them plenty of time to raise money. I don't think it necessarily hobbles him as governor at all if he's ready to use or threaten to use his veto. You got to remember the legislature is divided almost right down the middle. He's still in a position to pick one party or the other on any particular issue. They all know that some very unpleasant things are going to have to be done, and I think they'll all be very glad to blame the governor when they have to do it, and then he goes away.
Well, and that's part of it, right? If they were going to have to blame the governor anyway, and as he's said over and over again, he's taken the brunt of an awful lot of the blame, even if that blame shouldn't necessarily be at his door about the budget process. As we said repeatedly over the course of the last couple of weeks, he's one of the most unpopular governors in all of America, in part because of some of these things. So is what you're saying, well, he's just going to make himself a little bit more unpopular. Doesn't really matter. They can get the job done and blame him.
Well, he can take the unpopularity away from some of the legislators. They can say the governor made us do it, or, the governor was going to veto our bills.
I think they might try to hold on to some of that unpopularity themselves.
They will, but I think in a divided legislature, if he's ready to use his veto, he's going to be very much in charge for the next year and a half.
Well, I think that there's a couple things here. First off, I think that when has Dan Malloy ever really done things legislatively that with re-election in mind? He doesn't really seem to care that much. He's willing to do the unpopular thing, and that's sort of an interesting part of his legacy, that he's always been able to do, well, for the most part, he's done these things that are pretty unpopular, like raising taxes. I don't think he would necessarily do much that's different. However, I think in the back of legislative leaders' minds, they have to be thinking, is this the last time that we're going to see a mostly Democratic legislature and a Democratic governor, because there's a very good chance that this seat will flip.
I want to ask about that doing the unpopular thing, though. I wonder about that. When he had an opportunity, when he was elected the first time, and he told us over and over again about the enormous budget deficit that indeed was on his plate, $3.5 billion that he had to take a whack at, we did raise taxes. We did negotiate with state employee unions, but now a few years later on, we're still looking at probably raising taxes. We're still looking at negotiating with employee unions, and many observers have said much of that could have been done differently before in a more unpopular way without an eye toward reelection, and we would be in a better position now had we done those things back then.
Well, I don't know how true that is. I think that they were hoping that they could inflict the least amount of pain possible and that things would actually turn around. There kept being this sort of thinking that, if we do these things, we're going to get through it and things are going to pick up next year. And it never did. The revenue estimates kept being completely off. Revenue kept falling. They just didn't manage that. So I don't know. I don't think that that's necessarily true.
I have to say that I think all of us sitting here can say that we're not saying all this with the advantage of hindsight. At the time, it was pretty clear that these so-called concessions were sort of weak tea. You know, I remember saying at the time that in terms of sort of the health benefits and the health of state employees, I was most concerned that they would injure themselves jumping over the table to sign this deal, because it seemed like it didn't really ask very much of them. He sent Mark Ojakian in there, who was maybe a little greener than he is now. And also, OJ's just a really nice guy. I'm not really sure that's exactly who he needed in that situation. But he was also, at that moment, politically as beholden to state employees as he was ever going to be. So it was kind of maybe hard, even for a guy like Malloy, to do this. I just want to, before we can talk some more about this, and I want to hear what Chris says, but I just, before I forget, say, Chris made a really important point, which is that, you know, this is Malloy's last legislative session. Next year is Malloy's last legislative session. And if it is, because, I mean, another possibility is that he could vacate, you know? He could go someplace. That puts Nancy Wyman in as governor, Marty Looney in as lieutenant governor. And that'll change the whole political picture in this state. I mean, now that he's announced, presumably he just slogs it out, you know, through the campaign season next year. But I don't know that there's any guarantee of that. And that would change the conversation we're going to have in a few minutes quite a bit. But I'd love to hear what Chris thinks about the 2009 concessions. Or no, not 2009, 2011 concessions.
Oh, you know, you called them weak tea. I think they were, you know, plain water. Anybody remember the suggestion box that never got filled up? You know, that's something I think we have to hold the governor responsible for. I think he has realized that the raising taxes business is not working anymore. It's just, you know, driving economic activity out of the state. Yes, he got left a mess by his two Republican predecessors who, you know, were just doing all sorts of tricks. And but nevertheless, he did not fix things in his first year, second year, third year, up to his sixth year. There's some very serious changes that have to be made, changes to the premises of mistaken policies in Connecticut. We have all these fixed costs, and, you know, the budget director says more than half the budget is fixed costs. That is costs that you can't really do anything about. Well, you know, who fixed the costs? God didn't fix the costs. We fixed the costs by legislation and contract. The state is not going to be saved unless the fixed costs are unfixed. The governor has never tried to unfix the fixed costs.
Well, let's use that to pivot, perhaps, and I'll start with Susan, to this legacy piece of it. We have a governor who said, you know, I took on this job with this big budget deficit. We're going to talk about a few things that we remember from his first campaign. Shared sacrifice. Mm-hmm. We certainly heard an awful lot about generally accepted accounting principles, which was very boring to many people at the time. But we're going to change the way in which we view these numbers. We're going to be more transparent. I think if Keith Fanta from the Connecticut Mirror were here, he would say we have not been any more transparent, perhaps less transparent about where and how the money actually flows. What do you see as some of the big points in the Governor Malloy legacy about how he manages the budget or just how he manages to run the state?
There's a couple of things that he's done. There's the sort of fiscal cliff that we were going to walk off in a couple, and what was that, about 15 years or so. They say they fixed that. I don't know. I think that the number of state employees has gone down quite a number by a fairly large amount. So government's actually been shrinking a little bit. A lot of different services have been cut. You know, I think that we may see even more than that this year and next year. So that's part of his legacy, is that the government in Connecticut is actually different now than it was back in 2010. It is smaller. Whether or not it's more effective, I don't know, but it's definitely smaller than it was.
Colin, it's more expensive.
Yeah. Well, but it's more expensive, but it's smaller, but those costs are going to go up. You talk about those fixed costs. I mean, we've got employee contracts that were not written by this governor. You've got debt, which has been rolled up under this governor and previous governors. I mean, it is kind of hard to take a whack of those fixed costs. Quickly, Chris, I mean, what do you see as some of the highlights of the legacy?
I think, you know, the highlight is that...
I use the word highlight. Maybe that's the wrong word to have gone to you with, but what are some of the major points of the legacy you'd like to bring up?
I think overwhelmingly the state is insolvent, and the governor really has done very little to make it more solvent. you know, he's put more money into the pension fund. That was part of the state's insolvency, but we are more insolvent than ever. And all the little liberal nostrums that he has tried to enact in social policy, I think, will have very little impact on, you know, the actual living conditions in the state. You can't have any effective government as long as it's insolvent. And this was not addressed by Roland or Rell, and it hasn't been addressed by Governor Malloy either.
Outside of the budget, though, there are other points of legacy that need to be talked about, such as the busway, for example, a very important thing that actually did get done. He could have stopped it and didn't. But also, I think that the governor has been a good friend to the LGBT community, enacting a non-discrimination ordinance for people about gender identity was an important thing. And considering the climate that we're in right now, I think a very important thing and a very important step.
Colin?
Yeah, I sort of... one thing I would just want to say about the budget is, at least in this particular session, and I come here in here and say this every week, Malloy's the only person with any proposal at all, as far as I can see. He's made a proposal. He's identified priorities. There's an actual policy/ideology behind the priorities he's identified. And everybody else is just in the business of either blocking it or ducking it or ducking the issue. And I think one thing, Chris, that would agree, at the national level and at the state level, we have become a society in which both parties are much more interested in blocking the other party than in creating anything or fixing anything or figuring anything out. You know, I mean, the Republicans at the national level are, I think, in a state of disgrace. I mean, when Paul Ryan got up there after the failure of AHCA and admitted, he goes, basically, for the last 8 years, all we've done is block things, and we don't really know how to get things passed. Well, that's a pretty damning admission, you know? But I think the Democrats are drifting into that with Trump. I think they're less and less interested in creating anything and mostly interested in blocking his every move. And I think that's happened down at this level, too. At least you can say this session, Malloy, he's got a budget. It's identifiable. It's meaningful. It doesn't address some of the structural stuff that we've been talking about. But, yeah, I would give him credit also on the death penalty. Marijuana decriminalization, medical marijuana, I've got a list here, minimum wage, earned income tax credit, Jackson Labs, jury's still out on that, but I mean, biotech might be a pretty good sector for Connecticut to work with. It's a lot of money for that. He tried to do something after Sandy Hook. To me, the lesson of that is state gun laws probably don't make that much difference. I mean, it was great that he tried to do something. I'm not really sure ultimately that it'll have the.
Well, and he said over and over again, state gun laws don't really mean that much. He said that it's, you know, the guns are coming from Virginia. They're coming from other states. And that's what's affecting Connecticut.
I take away credit for he tried to weaken all the watchdog agencies. He did weaken all the watchdog agencies, and he weakened the campaign finance laws. One of the reasons that he's under investigation right now, or at least an operation that he was tied to is under investigation right now, is because they weakened the campaign law, finance laws, so there'd be more money sloshing around there. I'll say one last thing, which is, in addition to second chance, I think the other thing, let's say he stays on all the way through 2018, I think the other thing he's really got to do is really work with Luke Bronin. I mean, the state of the capital city of Connecticut right now is a disgrace. It's a financial disgrace. And stuff like the XL Center, which we'll be talking about, is a wreck, you know. And that just – it's untenable, you know. And I don't think it can be fixed that well at the local level. I know that state taxpayers – don't want to be in the business of propping up a government that they don't believe in and a city that they don't really care that much about. But that's got to get turned around somehow. That would be a great thing for Malloy to work on. He's always seemed kind of committed to the idea of Hartford as our capital city in a way that some governors haven't. So I'd love to see him make that a priority down the home stretch.
I'm obligated to get a comment from Chris Powell about what Colin just said.
Well, you know, about Hartford, I read in the Hartford Current that, you know, a big problem with the the spending increase in Mayor Bronin's budget is increased debt service costs. Well, didn't they just spend $71 million on a minor league baseball stadium? The money was borrowed.
To be fair, that was a dumb idea.
Well, okay. But you know what? It was also the governor's dumb idea. The governor could have stopped that dumb idea with a very simple statement that, well, if Hartford, which was on the brink of insolvency when they voted for the stadium, if Hartford had money for the stadium, the state government had money that it could take away from Hartford in the exact equivalent amount to prevent that stadium, which was only a scheme to steal New Britain's team, a team from another distressed city. The governor washed his hands of that.
Well, my sense is behind the scenes, he was saying a lot of that stuff to them.
But he didn't say anything public, and he could have killed the stadium. He could have said, if you've got $50 million for the stadium, we're going to take $50 million off your state aid. He didn't do that. He let Hartford screw New Britain, another equally distressed city, and now Hartford's got a debt service problem. Oh, really?
I don't know that he necessarily could have stopped it. I'm sure he could have said a couple of things and maybe made a couple of threats. But it seems like this thing came out of the stadium came out of the blue, and it kind of hit everybody at once. It was a terrible idea, and it was terribly done. And I think that they would have rushed into it regardless. I think that they had baseball stars in their eyes, and they wouldn't have stopped for anything.
Yeah, minor league baseball stars are hard to get out of your eyes. Susan Bigelow's here. She's a columnist for CTNewsJunkie.com. Chris Powell, managing editor of the Journal Enquirer newspaper, and also Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. We'll be back to talk about what happens next. Who might run for Governor Malloy's seat? This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com, Chris Powell from the Journal Enquirer, and Colin McEnroe from his own Colin McEnroe Show. What's on the show today, Colin?
It's a conversation that we did on April 5th at Watkinson School about changes in the language, the way the language changes politically, the way it changes to reflect new currents in our social contract. This is a really fun panel. I really recommend listening to this show.
This will be fun this afternoon at 1 o'clock with the Colin McEnroe Show. Let's turn to what's going to happen in the wake of Governor Malloy's announcement that he's not running for re-election. You threw out one tiny thing that I do want to just loop back to, Colin, which is, you know, he may not serve out the term. He said repeatedly he will serve out the term. Were he not to serve out the term, Lieutenant Governor Nancy Wyman would step into the role. And, of course, she is seen as a potential front runner for that job, at least on the Democratic side. But who are you looking at as possible candidates here?
Well, first of all, the other thing I have to say is that Marty Looney said within the last couple of days that if that happened and he became lieutenant governor and then Nancy Wyman, who would be acting governor, decided she didn't want to run for governor, then he and seagulls spelled his name in the sky, he would then run for governor. It was like pretty complicated. Like a lot of things had to happen. But I'm not. So I do have seven dwarfs on each side. So I've got we've got Dan Drew, Jonathan Harris, Chris Maddy, Nancy Wyman, Kevin Lembo, Joe Ganim, who seems to, I don't know what's going on with that, and Ted Kennedy. So their dwarf names are Grabby, Dreamy, Watchful, Happy. Lembo is actually a pretty good dwarf name. Sneaky and Drowsy.
Those are on the Democratic side. I mean, who rises to the top of the list? I mean, as I said, Nancy Wyman is happy dwarf, and I think a lot of people kind of get out of her way, right?
Yeah, I mean, I hope she doesn't run. I know that's not a good thing for somebody who like comments on politics to say. I hope she doesn't run. And I here's what I think. Let me make it more general. If the only reason to run, it's going to be a nasty, hard-fought campaign. They all are. This one might be worse. And then you get a job that's also just nasty and full of all kinds of challenges that we've just been discussing. The only reason to subject yourself to this is if you have a policy vision that you think is so far superior to everybody else's and so dear to your heart that you couldn't live with yourself if you didn't pursue the opportunity to implement your ideas. I don't think that's Nancy Wyman. I mean, maybe I'm drastically misappraising her, but I don't think that's Nancy Wyman. And if so, I don't think she should run.
Out of those Democrats, I mean, what are you saying here?
Well, I think that the left would like to see Kevin Lembo. I think that he's somebody who's been interesting to them for a long time. They think that he's kind of a progressive candidate, and I think that he has a chance to kind of occupy that slot. That said, I think that there's a lot of other people that are going to try to occupy that slot as well. I don't know if like Jonathan Harris has much of a chance. I don't know if I really see that. Chris Maddy, who by the way was in my high school class. That's my new claim to fame that I went to school with Chris Maddy.
Was he class prosecutor?
Yes, he was. Yeah. Yes, he was. But no, he may try to get in and do that kind of thing as well. Is there sort of a Bernie Sanders candidate for this race? I don't know. But if anybody's going to be it, I think Kevin Lembo is going to be. So I think he's very interesting. I'm going to watch him.
Well, but Lembo hasn't declared And my sense of limbo is it's not a lock that he's running, you know.
And certainly not a lock he's running if somebody like Nancy Wyman is still hanging around thinking about doing this. What do you see in all these Democrats? I mean, the name Kevin Limbo, Chris, comes up. Here's someone who has preached a type of fiscal responsibility, trying to take a look under the hood at some of the numbers that the Malloy administration has put out. He's been talking openly about and creating tools for transparency, things that a lot of us take a look at and say, okay, well, that makes a lot of sense. What do you see in some of the Democrats?
Well, the comptroller, I think, has been taking some positions over the last few months that indicate differences with the governor, and I sense that he was positioning himself for his own campaign. I'm with Colin. I don't really sense that Nancy Wyman wants to be governor. I mean, if you want to be governor, there's got to be a reason, and I don't know what the reason for Nancy to run again would be. But you know, the other ones, maybe they could break out by standing for something. And you know, other than trivia, I have no idea what they stand for.
Well, one thing, because we'll probably have to take a break and come back and then talk about potential Republicans in the race. But what about this idea of split government? It's been a while now since we had a Republican governor and a Democratic legislature. Of course, we already saw the switch in the last election where we have a nearly evenly divided legislature. Do you feel, Chris, as though this state is heading toward yet another Republican governor heading up a mostly blue state? We've seen it all across New England.
Oh, I think anything could happen in the next election. I think the Republicans could even take the House. I think the Democrats could win the governorship again.
Very quickly, every time that there's been an open seat race, and this is going to be an open seat race in 2018, the party has changed. The party in the governor's office has changed.
Colin, just about 1 minute, a thought on this, and we'll get to the Republicans afterward.
I mean, divided government in Connecticut, our experience with it has been kind of weird because it, for the most part, hasn't been. I mean, you know, Roland did not really have an adversarial relationship with the party at either chamber. I mean, in fact, he worked better with them than he did with his own party. So, you know, a lot of this would depend on who got elected. Like, if Themis Claridis gets elected governor, I would predict a really interesting and somewhat adversarial relationship between the governor and the majority, and, you know, and any party, and the Democrats in the House. But we'll see.
We'll take a look at those Republicans who might be vying for that seat and talk about some of the other news of the week, including Bill O'Reilly's really terrible bad week. But we're going to do that right after we hear from some of my colleagues who are going to tell you why you should support The Wheelhouse and all the other things that you hear here on WMPR. And do support it right now because it's very important. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Susan Bigelow, columnist at ctnewsjunkie.com, Chris Powell, managing editor of The Journal Inquirer, and Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. I'll just quickly say that Governor Malloy, who we've been speaking about quite a bit, is going to be on Where We Live with Lucy Nalpathanchil on May 1st. You can tune in for that. And I'm going to be talking about governors around New England. The fact is that in all these blue states, we've got an awful lot of Republican governors and a few Democratic governors who aren't terribly popular right now. We're going to be hearing from political observers in New Hampshire and Rhode Island and also here in Connecticut coming up on next tomorrow at 2 o'clock. So let's just finish our conversation, Colin, about people who could be running for Governor Malloy's seat. We went through some of the Democrats, and there's probably a lot more to say about that. But who's on the list right now for Republicans? Because, you know, Republicans have had some time to think about this. Do they have a pretty good group of, as you would call them, dwarves?
Yeah, there's seven dwarves over there, too. All right, let me just say that one thing that we do that's kind of unfair when we talk about this is we sort of lump everybody together, the people who've actually put their markers down, the people who have been floating trial balloons, the people who have almost done nothing but are just getting talked about for whatever reason. We stick them all together. But yeah, my seven dwarves on the Republican side are Loretti, Herbst, Srinivasan, Themis Claridis, Mark Boughton, Peter Lumage, and David Walker, otherwise known as Sketchy, Nasty, Doc, Edgy, Quirky, Nutty, and Sleepy.
And do you see any of those dwarves as particularly interesting or noteworthy, perhaps rising to the top of this field after a bit?
You know, I honestly don't know. I really don't know. You can't go by how much money they raise because, like, Lumage seems to be able to raise some money, but I think he's raising it from a pretty fringe group that isn't really going to, you know, represent any part, even of the primary electorate. So I don't know. I mean, I feel as though Boughton sort of is still kind of the putative leader, but not in a particularly substantive and meaningful way. I find myself thinking that depending on the climate. I mean, you know, we haven't really talked very much about Georgia last night or Kansas. You know, if it's a kind of buyer's remorse election nationally in 2018, then maybe a candidate like Themis Claridis isn't such a great idea because she ultimately did line herself up with Trump and she has a kind of combative quality to her. But I actually think she'd make for a very exciting race anyway. And so I don't know. Basically, what I'm saying is I don't know. I have no idea who the front runner is.
Well, okay, and I can ask you about who you think a front runner might be, Chris. But also, I mean, what do you think that the Republicans should do? Two times in a row, we got a rich guy from Greenwich, Tom Foley. If Governor Malloy made some bad economic projections about the economy coming back and saving us, Tom Foley made some really disastrous ones, didn't have a whole lot of plans in place, and he lost twice in a row. It would seem as though Republicans don't have a big stomach for that kind of candidate again. What do you think would work?
Well, you know, they've tried self-funding ignoramuses for, you know, the last, what, 4 or 6 years.
That's
you know,
so
I think
that wasn't even my college band. Self-funding ignoramuses.
I don't see anybody in that list who's got enough money that he can buy the nomination. I think that's a good start. You know, Boughton has been a very successful mayor in a very successful city for a long time. He is not shown a lot of talent politically when he's run before. David Walker's got a very good reputation as a competent guy in Washington. I don't think he's got, unfortunately, any political standing within the Republican Party. He ran before and I guess came in second for lieutenant governor. But, you know, again, I think this is a situation where people can distinguish themselves if they want to stand for something. I have never gotten the impression that the Republican opposition in Connecticut wants to stand for something. But, you know, there's always a first time.
Susan?
I don't see a real front runner at all. I don't think that there really is one at this point. None of the candidates, I don't think, are all that exciting at this point. I do agree with Colin that I think that Mark Boughton is probably sort of kind of the front runner. But, no, he really isn't that interesting of a candidate once he gets out of Danbury. I think the same is true for, you know, Herbst once he gets out of his town.
And they're also opposite personalities, right? Boughton is very likable, and I mean Herbst, you know.
Boughton reminds me of that sort of dad who comes into their kid's room and goes, "Hey, kid, what's going on? Are you getting jiggy with it? How's it going?" The sort of clueless dad, he's a nice guy.
Maybe more like the stepdad who's trying to get you to like him.
Yeah,
you know, like he's dating your mom.
He's trying really, really hard. Right, Big Papa. That's him. But yes, I think he's okay. He's not great, but I think that Themis Claridis would also be very interesting if she did run. But I don't know. I think that there's an opportunity here for somebody else to come in.
Yeah.
A quick question for you, Colin. Chris has said this a couple times. If someone was to stand for something, they could distinguish themselves. I mean, what would a Republican governor who is running to kind of fix some of the problems of the state right now, what would he or she stand for? I mean, what would be the winning strategy, do you think?
This is a very tough question, first of all, but the kinds of things they should hire Chris as a speechwriter. I mean, a lot of the stuff that Chris has been talking about, that ultimately if you don't go in there and wrestle with and fix some of these structural problems that have gone unaddressed for 8 years, let's be fair, many, many more than 8 years. In the case of funding pensions, it's decades and decades of neglect by both parties. That you're going to have to do that, and you're going to have to make people shed some tears and feel some pain and probably spill a little bit of blood on the ice while you're at it. But I, your candidate, am willing to do that because I put the citizens of Connecticut first ahead of everything else. You know, and I think the other part of this is, I mean, like one of the reasons Tom Foley is like the only candidate I've ever sat down with for coffee. You know how they email you and say, "Let's have coffee." And I never do. But I had coffee with Tom Foley. And Tom Foley's big blind spot was he kept telling me that they really didn't like Malloy, but they liked him. And I kept thinking, no, people don't like either one of you. You know, you're not coming across all that different from Dan Malloy. Part of this is, some of politics is optics and fairly superficial issues of charisma and personality. You know, and notwithstanding that, Dan Malloy got elected. But ultimately, finding somebody who's inspiring, somebody who really does have the ability to grab the attention of the electorate. And in a state where the numbers weigh so heavily against Republican candidates, somebody who can – I mean, look, this is one of the reasons John Roland won three different elections. You know, I mean, there are a lot of things wrong with John Roland, many, many more things wrong than right. But he was able to do that kind of thing, and they probably need somebody at least with his flair.
And he was followed up, Chris, by Jody Rell, someone who – didn't do an awful lot as governor, but was very much beloved because she was a very, very nice person. Is that part of the formula here? Just be a nicer person.
She seemed like a pretty nice person.
Well, she stayed out of jail, which she got a lot of credit for after Roland. But, you know, she kicked the can down, you know, the road to Malloy, just as, you know, Roland had done it to her. She was not a leader in the governor's office. I don't know politically, John, what the winning formula in Connecticut is, but I am convinced that this state barely has one more election to straighten its government out by questioning the premises, the mistaken premises of policy. If it's not done very soon, the state is toast.
Yeah, I also would like to comment on what Colin said earlier about this sort of national political wins. I think 2018 is going to be a really weird election year. I don't think that we're going to see things that, you know, I think that the rules that we've seen before are not necessarily going to hold. I think that there's going to be some of that buyer's remorse. I also think there's going to be other forces in play. So things that are not necessarily just Connecticut things, like, yes, we're mad at our Democratic governor. Maybe we would want to switch to somebody else. But then there might be a Democratic wave building. Who knows? So I think that it's really completely up for grabs.
I think it makes a difference, too, where you are. And we don't have a lot of data points, so it's irresponsible to be speculating. But let's be irresponsible anyway. I mean, I think you look at, like, that district in Kansas, that's a really red district. So it was pretty easy for the Democrat to overperform and the Republican to underperform because, in fact, the bar for the Republican in that Kansas district was very high. Now, last night, you know, Ossoff's performance wasn't the kind of margin. If you look at the lean of that district in presidential elections, Ossoff outperformed that lean as a Democrat. But it's a little bit more of a mixy kind of place. It's harder to do a big thing. So here in Connecticut, where we're latently, you know, a blue state and a Democratic state, it's probably going to make less of a difference here. I, you know, there are less Republicans available to desert their posts, you know, as voters. And so it may not be quite as dramatic a thing in a place like this. But does that make any sense, what I just said?
It does, yeah. But I think we really can't tell.
Yeah, it's too early.
Yeah, I don't know.
Do we know anything? And somebody on Twitter just reminded me, as we listed all the people who say that they're running, not running, we forgot to mention J.C. Wyatt, Colin, who I know almost nothing about.
Yeah, J.C. Wyatt is a transgender candidate who has made a point of saying that that transgender issues would not be a major part of that campaign. And that's like about as much as I know right now.
Yeah.
I don't even think J.C. Wyatt has picked a party. I would guess.
He had grown up as a Republican. Do you know anything about J.C. Wyatt?
I know very little about J.C. Wyatt. I think that she said a couple of things about trying to work with Trump. And I don't know. I've just kind of ignored her.
Just okay, so we've ignored J.C. Wyatt.
Her big quote was, "My body obviously does not look like a typical politician," which is something Joe Visconti also says. So I don't know who said it first. We'd have to find out.
Okay, let's quickly just move to this news this week. So Hartford has this failing infrastructure. It's got this failing Excel Center, but yet somehow or other, Susan, we're able to manage to attract men's tournament basketball games in 2019. That's kind of a big deal for the city.
Is it? I wonder. The men's tournament, the first round, the regional games, I don't know. I mean, is that really a huge, huge, huge draw? It's a huge draw on TV, absolutely. But is it a huge draw in person? You look at the tournament from this past year, you would see a lot of empty seats. And it's not surprising. I mean, are people in Hartford really going to care that much about seeing, like, the University of Southern Utah playing Penn State Hazleton in the first round or whatever? So it sounds like a big thing, but I don't necessarily think that it's going to make as huge of a difference as we think.
How about lacrosse at Rentschler? That's going to be huge.
Oh, yeah.
Should we care at all about men's basketball tournament coming to the Hartford Civic Center, I'll still call it?
Will they bring $250 million with them?
I knew he was going to say something like that.
Well, but look, it is kind of a mixed bag a little bit. I mean, we're making this case, Colin, that we need to have a new stadium to play basketball in, but if we're able to attract to this antiquated old facility, a major tournament like this, I don't know, maybe we don't need $250 million worth of renovations.
Well, you kind of want to know the behind-the-scenes TikTok of all this. I mean, I can't believe that representatives of the NCAA, having beheld the current state of the XL Center, said, oh, yeah, that's where we want to do this. I assume there may have been assurances made to them, perhaps rash. And it's certainly a cart before a horse kind of situation. Like, yeah, let's get this commitment from the NCAA. And then we have to fix up the stadium. But as Chris says, it's a $250 million price tag. That's what the CRDA is now budgeting to get this thing into some kind of presentable shape. But I don't get it, actually. I don't know how you would have that event here, given the current state of that thing. I suggested in our emails, maybe they just all go to Lowe's and just DIY it.
I think Susan's making the case that maybe just not that many people show up, so you don't have to worry about long lines
at
the bathroom.
Yeah, but it's on TV and stuff. And
it's going to look.
You don't do any shots of the upper parts of the building. You just focus on the floor. We could make a nice floor.
Well, ESPN has been saying the overhead lights are so loud that they hate doing games there now because they make this humming noise that's impossible to put on television. Look, I wasn't sure what to end with today, but I think we probably have to end in the last minute or so about the fact is that by the time the show reruns tonight at 7 o'clock, Bill O'Reilly may be out of a job at Fox News. We've heard a number of announcements already this morning saying that Fox is looking for its plan beyond Bill O'Reilly. $13 million later after a series of sexual harassment lawsuits settled by him and Fox News. What do we make of this?
There sure seems to be an awful lot of misogyny happening at Fox News. It doesn't surprise me at all that there is, that this kind of misogyny goes hand in hand with this kind of bomb-throwing, hyper-masculine, hard right philosophy. It doesn't surprise me at all. But, you know, I am feeling a little bit of schadenfreude, but I honestly don't think it matters as much as we think it does. I think Bill O'Reilly was in the middle of being eclipsed by sort of way, way out there people like Alex Jones.
Well, Alex Jones has had his own bad week this week.
Yes.
I thought about Bill O'Reilly going away, Chris.
You know, I don't think I've ever watched Fox, John. I think there's a little too much bombast on operations like that for me. So wish them the worst in any case.
Colin, Bill O'Reilly thought?
The whole thing is kind of resembled our bizarre attitude towards athletes, right? I mean, they actually dealt more severely, more quickly with Roger Ailes than they did with Bill O'Reilly, which is not the way the world works for the most part, except in these situations where, you know, the person who's selling tickets, metaphorically speaking, is much harder to get rid of. So, I mean, they had all the reason they needed to get rid of O'Reilly weeks and weeks and weeks ago. It's taken a really long time because it's like an NFL football player. You hate to get rid of them if you're that team.
Colin McEnroe, Chris Powell, Susan Bigelow in the Wheelhouse, thank you for joining us. Here are some colleagues to tell you how you can support the Wheelhouse and everything else on WNPR.